This podcast is brought to you by the RNIB Children, Young People, Families and Education team in partnership with Fight Against Blindness. It's part of the Emotional Support series. This information will be useful for parents, carers and professionals who work with children with vision impairment and may also be useful for young people themselves.
Hello and welcome. Thanks again for joining us for this podcast. In the Emotional Support series, I'm Craig Brown from RNIB's Children, Young People and Families team. Today I'm here again joined by my colleague Laura. Hi Laura.
Hi.
Hiya. And we've got, as always, Ian McCubbin from Fight Against Blindness. How are we doing, Ian?
I'm very well. Hello Craig, hello Laura, thanks for having me back on again.
No, it's great to have you as always. So today, just before we start, Ian, for anyone who's listening to this podcast for the first time that haven't heard any of the other podcasts in the series, could you just introduce FAB, so Fight Against Blindness, and what it is you guys do?
Sure. So I'm a clinical psychologist, and I work with children at Oxford Children's Hospital. And as part of my role there, the charity Fight Against Blindness, or FAB, they fund me to see children with visual impairments and eye conditions at Oxford's eye hospital. They, as it happens, fund, I think, four or five, maybe even six now, psychologists across England to do similar jobs. So their main remit is to try and support psychologists in working with children with sight loss.
Great. And so today's topic, Ian, we're going to be talking about coping with a new diagnosis. And this is going to be kind of centered around those feelings that parents, but also the children and kind of siblings all experience in that, in the kind of the period of a new diagnosis. So to start off with, Ian, often what we hear from families is they go through different stages during this experience, and they can be feeling a range of emotions. So can we talk about those different stages?
Yeah, of course. It's a very widely held belief, I think, that there are stages to go through when you experience a loss, or if there's a big change, or a potentially traumatic event, or a big new chronic or life-changing health diagnosis. This idea, it comes, I suppose, fundamentally from research and from the literature on bereavement. So there's this idea of the stages of grief. And in that model, there are several stages that people pass through while dealing with the bereavement. So traditionally, I think it's denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And laterally, one of the researchers that's associated with this model kind of tacked on one called meaning. Now, it's a really useful model for a whole host of reasons. Some people find it less satisfying now. You know, in modern days, we have perhaps a slightly different understanding of patterns of adjustment and coping. But one really useful thing, or a couple of really useful things about this model, acknowledges the fact that people have different responses. So the idea that there could be a bit of anger, a bit of denial, some sadness, something that looks like acceptance eventually, I think is a very reasonable one, and indeed a very accurate one. So it's useful from that perspective, that people will pass through, and there are certain tasks they may need to complete and come into grips with some of these things. Again, I think it's quite a useful one. The idea also that, I guess, this takes time, of course. This is, again, a very well understood thing. But when faced with a huge life change to adjust to, and I suppose in this context we're thinking about a child's diagnosis with an eye condition of some sort, or a visual impairment, that this is big news. This is a real significant thing to have to try and cope with. And the idea of there will be stages to this news, and there will be stages to this adjustment process, and actually the whole family, parents, the child themselves, perhaps their siblings, will be going through this process at their own pace. And actually, there may be people who are presenting as being furiously angry when others are very sad. And suddenly, there may be people who are getting to something that looks like a bit of acceptance, while other members of the family may be stuck somewhere that looks a bit like denial. It's also worth mentioning, I think, the idea that at the end of the stage process, there's the idea of meaning. And meaning in this process can mean different things. There are ideas around after a potentially traumatic event, people will reappraise their lives and their existence a bit, and they can find something transformative, potentially. There's a whole literature that we may have mentioned fleetingly in a previous podcast around post-traumatic growth. So something potentially traumatic happens, and it can be extremely painful in the immediate and short and medium and perhaps indeed long term, but eventually through this process some insight or greater understanding is reached. So that sort of story is not terrifically unusual, actually, the idea of finding meaning. And there are a couple of instances, I think, of people who perhaps we can link to beside this podcast, of people who through the process of having a visual impairment, young people I'm thinking of actually, and losing some or all of their sight, actually ended up with a better level of psychological adjustment or happiness or fulfillment than they did beforehand. So yeah, the stages thing for me is about that, really. There's a process to go through, and people will go through that process at their own time, but it will take time.
And so in terms of these stages, Ian, will parents necessarily go through each and every stage, or and might they start in one stage, or is it structured?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and that touches on the idea that I mentioned really briefly there, around how this is a really useful model, but perhaps there are aspects of its specificity or it's maybe not quite as intricate or as modern as some others. And this is not as prescriptive a process as some people would believe it to be. And perhaps, in fact, I think it's fair to say that the people who, the woman in the first instance, and then her colleague who was male that designed this stages model, they may not have not had such a prescriptive process in their mind when they pulled it together, actually, that it wasn't that you entered this process at denial and you exited at acceptance or meaning and you passed through the stages sequentially. I think it's fair to say, actually, people enter us at various different points, and actually then they may work through it in what looks like a forward direction. They may go through denial and anger, then bargaining. They may actually go through it in the opposite direction. They may jump between different emotional states. I mean, the ultimate aim for anyone is something that looks a bit like acceptance, and the initial starting point will be far more changing and shifting and associated with far more difficult emotions. But like you asked, Craig, I think this is not a exactly sequential process, and people do flip between them and are likely to flip between them at a different speed and in a different order than their partner or their children will.
So Ian, just when parents maybe are responding differently, because obviously people will take this news in the same way, but again, we kind of turn to our partners for support, and if maybe that person is not in that position to offer the kind of support that we need, is this something you would experience a lot, where parents would take this news very differently?
Absolutely. I think both you and Craig are hitting on probably the single most important idea about parental coping with this type of news, which is essentially all bets are off. There are a huge range of what you would reasonably consider to be normal responses to this type of event or this type of news. That can include all the things that we mentioned before about the stages. And then acknowledging that, you know, people will react in different ways, and sometimes that might mean there's conflict within couples, or at least there is incompatible types of coping. There may be incompatible emotional needs in that moment. So that's something that we see quite a lot at the Children's Hospital and the parents that we try and support, and particularly, I think, amongst the parents we support with children at time of diagnosis, I think. You know, for some parents under these circumstances, they really want to know what the future will hold. They want to sit down with the ophthalmologist or the ECLO or whomever is they have the best relationship with amongst the care team and say, okay, give me in great detail what things are going to look like for my child 6 months, a year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the line. How is this trajectory going to play out? And some parents, that is the last thing they want to think about. They don't want to go anywhere near that sort of stuff. They want to focus on the present moment, deal with stuff they can right now, and that's it. And again, this starts to look tricky because if one parent wants to hear all about the stuff in the future, and that, by the way, that could be positive and negative. They may want to hear about the potential progression of the diagnosis. They may want to hear about innovative treatments, gene therapies and stuff coming down the line. While the other parent, again, doesn't want to engage in that. But you can see how these things actually are not only incompatible, they're kind of oppositional. One negates the existence of the other. In the first instance, I suppose, understanding that both these positions are, from my perspective, and I think from any respectable psychologist working in this field's perspective, normal. Some people will want to talk about it, some don't. The fact that somebody wants to engage fully in all the aspects of the diagnosis and understand it completely and another one doesn't, does not mean that the other one is necessarily in denial, to use a word that we used earlier, or bottling things up. It may be, but there's a certain legitimacy in that, particularly immediately after hearing news of this type. There is an idea, and it's a bit like that stages model we discussed, but also a bit not. And I think I mentioned it fleetingly in a previous podcast. There's a researcher, an American chap called George Bonanno, who looks at people coping after a potentially traumatic event, including actually life-changing diagnoses. And his research suggests that there are different trajectories people follow. Some people, it will have a massive impact, this type of news, if it's about them or their child and their functioning, and that may persist for quite some time. For some people, it has relatively little impact upon them, and there is a group in the middle where the impact may only become apparent across time, and a third group for whom across time they will recover. They'll notice the impact lessening. Now, all four of these trajectories, the idea of the chronically impaired, the delayed reaction, the recovered person, and the people who are just, for whatever reason, that bit more resilient. This is not symptomatic or a sign of some people care more than others. This is just the fact that humanity is hard to predict and variable. And within the idea of normal human reactions, there is this variance, actually. And within partners, again, one person may be feeling completely overwhelmed. One may look like they are relatively unaffected, but neither of them may be in a place of denial or somehow pathological behavior. So the important thing, I suppose, the fundamentally important thing in a couple where it's two people who are looking after one child and both are having their own reaction to this diagnosis, this piece of news, is to try and find time to sit down together and discuss this. Now, that might seem obvious, but many of these discussions may be taking place with health professionals or potentially educational professionals. Many of these conversations will be taking place with the child or perhaps other children around. And actually to sit down with you and have a conversation around how you both are, how you're coping, how you may both be feeling with what's been going on, and try to do so in a uninterrupted, really emotionally connected way. You know, ditch the phones, TV turned off, sit down and really try and get in touch with how you both are coping and see how you can both best meet the other's needs and to negotiate that a bit. Can one person get slightly more involved in thinking about the implications of this diagnosis in the future? For example, you know, can you find out where your partner is hurting most and find some way to comfort them, essentially? So although that division, or that difference, I suppose is a better word, in types of coping might be very apparent and indeed maybe very normal, the best way, I think, to address it as a couple is to try and find that space to comfort each other and try and negotiate some way through it. So even though there may be an element of disharmony, that doesn't mean it has to stay that way.
Yeah, and just picking up on what you're saying as well about those conversations, you know, one of the things that parents will often report to us that can cause conflict is often the way life works, it's often one parent who's maybe attending hospital appointments and then having to go back and kind of explain all this to, you know, their partner. And often there's more questions and stuff. So I kind of think it is maybe important as well for families to make that time where both parents can attend and get the answers to those questions that they have as well.
Yeah, absolutely agree. It's very difficult, isn't it? When one parent may feel under pressure to understand what could be fairly complicated information. And in fact, you know, as you guys will understand, and as parents listening to this will understand in great detail, the type of information you may receive from someone at the eye hospital, if you go to an appointment there, can be really complicated, super technical stuff. And one parent then going back and trying to, as best they can, report that back to, you know, the other parent or the other partner or whomever, is a really challenging task. And with an emotive and distressing subject, that then becomes compounded still further. So often, I think, where there is different coping styles or strategies, and there is maybe some sense of it would be useful not to be relying too heavily on one parent to feed back to the other, or one partner to feed back to the other, it makes a lot of sense for both to attend. And of course, under normal circumstances, that's hard. Under the lockdown that we're all now sat in on the 5th of November 2020, it becomes much harder still, I guess. And who knows when eye hospital outpatient appointments may return entirely to normal. Where we are, they are largely back to that. But again, both parents can't come to appointments at the moment for most things at the children's hospital. So having both parents there to hear bits of news becomes harder. But technologies, like we're talking through at the moment, can sometimes allow both parents to be present to talk to the professional and get all the information that they might need.
And I guess picking up from something you said earlier, Ian, a lot of the hospitals have eye clinic liaison officers who can go through that information after an appointment with families and talk to them, maybe not using the kind of medical terms, but using terms that are just kind of a bit more friendly, so that you can really get an understanding of what's going on.
Mm.
So what I'm hearing is communication with each other is so important at this kind of stage, and understanding each other's kind of different reactions and why they might be happening. So as well as that, what other kind of support might parents need during those kind of initial stages, Ian?
Okay, so again, this is obviously going to vary according to need. And this is the thing that I guess I'll keep coming back to, that it is very individual. And it's sometimes actually, I think, probably quite difficult to be aware of what we might need in the moment. So taking time to pause and think as an individual, as well as a couple, to sort of check in with yourself. How am I feeling here? Am I overwhelmed? How do I usually cope? What are my needs in this? There is this real fundamental idea in looking after children, which is, you know, you can't pour from an empty cup, or to reach for another metaphor, you know, always put your own oxygen mask and the crashing plane on before you put your child's on. You need to look after yourself in order to be equipped to look after them. So, you know, pause, identify how you are, and reflect on your own needs, I think. That might mean doing what you usually do to look after yourself. So this has been a hugely trying year for lots of people, and enormously trying and hugely traumatic for many. What we've been through with the pandemic, and what people with a visual impairment in particular have endured with aspects of this, means we have all probably had to draw on the things that nourish us psychologically that bit more than we might usually need to. So if you're somebody who needs to exercise, make sure you are getting sufficient exercise in whatever form that takes. You know, you can't go to the gym at the moment. Can you get out for a run? Can you get out for a cycle? Can you get out for a walk? Can you do a Joe Wicks exercise thing in your living room? Can you do whatever you need from that perspective? Is it keeping up with friends and family? I think many of us are now probably at the point of stepping away from Zoom quizzes and things because we're all slightly fatigued with video calls. But, you know, again, how can you contact people that are important to you to try and look after your own emotional well-being at the point of your child receiving a diagnosis? So do all the important self-care stuff. Craig, you mentioned the iClinic liaison officers. Again, you know, super important to try and identify the best people to bridge that gap between potentially hugely technical medical information and your own understanding. And I absolutely count myself in that group. I am not an ophthalmologist. I don't have that understanding of the structure and function of the eye as my colleagues would. Equally, I'm not an optometrist. I don't have their level of insight about all the technical stuff they know too. So having the support of the ECLO or whomever else is around, be it the qualified teacher for the visually impaired, the QTVI from the VI team in education, be it the optometrist himself, the ophthalmologist, try and make sure you have all the information. It may be, and in fact it fairly often is actually, that some aspect of misapprehension, some bit of information that isn't necessarily the case, may be causing you extra distress or upset, when in fact that could be clarified if you just get the right information from one of these people, or if someone like an ECLO can help complicated information into something that's that bit more understanding. So important stuff that, I think. Other good sources of information may help too. The RNIB, obviously, great place to go. They've got a really brilliant page of the website that is to do with information for parents of children. There are a couple of very good leaflets around new diagnoses and how to understand them and what support you may need to make sense of them. So have a look at that stuff. There's a very good website, which is siteadvicefaq.org.uk, which again has got lots of FAQs, as the name suggests, frequently asked questions, which have answers for a whole host of things, not just for parents, but there is a section on that, and there's lots of relevant information for parents to access there too. There are, of course, many parents who are very keen to talk to the parents of other children who may have a similar diagnosis, and the utility in that, I guess, varies, I think, and how useful it is, based on when their child may have been diagnosed, or when the parents that you're trying to talk to, when that child may have been diagnosed, what diagnosis they have, how old the child is, and generally speaking, of course, the closer this family may be to your own family in terms of diagnosis, age of child, etc., the more useful it often is, although not always. Now, of course, there are the RNIB forums and Facebook, I think, that you can perhaps talk to other parents on digitally. Like, this is in these days particularly the most sensible source of support, but again, talking to somebody who's been through a similar process recently, who will be best placed to inform what you're going through, not just in terms of how they cope, but also in terms of the information they accessed, because even the professionals, they've not been, well, they may have been, but you cannot presume they have been in your shoes, and certainly not recently. So the best sort of information is, I think, the freshest sort of information, the newest sort of information, and that's likely to be derived from parents who have been in a similar position to you. So talk to other parents wherever you can find them, I think.
Yeah, that's great. Again, and our parents' Facebook page is really busy, and there is a lot of support and information there for parents. One of the other things that would be parents would talk to us quite a lot about is feelings of guilt, especially around hereditary conditions, maybe even that they didn't know about, but that kind of feeling of helplessness or guilt about what's happened, as if it's their fault. Is that something you would see a lot as well?
There is, of course, a very significant proportion of the conditions that children may present with at the eye hospital that are, as you said, you know, inherited genetic conditions. And they, I think, do evoke a very certain set of emotions in parents following diagnosis. You know, like you said, there can be a lot of guilt, there can be a lot of self-blame, and these can be really enormously upsetting and in some senses destructive or self-destructive emotions to try and deal with. Of course, there are genetics counsellors, there are people at the eye hospital who will hopefully be well placed to support people through the process of genetic testing and to make sense of stuff. But often, I think, we see parents who find that aspect of it that was, in some senses, inherited, particularly hard to deal with and particularly hard to bear. It's difficult, you know, and it's particularly challenging, I think, to talk about this in this context on a podcast without sounding a little bit glib about what's a very serious and profoundly upsetting subject for many of the parents we see. It is always worth reminding people that something may be genetic and it may, from that perspective, be inherited. But of course, for none of the parents we see, none of them would have wanted to have given this to their child. This is not done volitionally. This is done, as Laura, you alluded to. In the vast majority of cases, people may not realize that they are a carrier for this condition. And even if they do, this is not something that they would have wanted to pass on to their child. So the idea of, this is my fault, or I gave this to my child, whatever breathing space a parent can get between that and themselves, I think is enormously important. One thing we always ask people, or we would often ask people, is if they are feeling that way, the idea of it's my fault, or I did this, how would they advise one of their friends if their friends was expressing thoughts like this? So if your best friend was saying, this is my fault, how would you counsel them? What guidance would you give them? And an attempt to, again, try and just shape that thought a bit and try and offer the parents a little bit of an alternative. From a kind of technical perspective, you can do something that's usually called thought challenging. So thought challenging is a cognitive idea or a cognitive behavioral therapy technique. So if you're being troubled by the idea of this is my fault, you might want to try and think about the evidence for and the evidence against that thought. So as if it was an idea or a bit of evidence being presented in a court. So this is my fault. Maybe the evidence for that. Okay, it is genetic. My child got those genes from me, whatever else. The evidence against it, well, of course, I had no idea I had these genes, or I love my child and would do anything for them. And then you can try and rewrite the original thought and do this literally, on a bit of paper. Try and rewrite that thought, taking into account all the new information that you've discovered and looking at the evidence for and the evidence against it. So this is my fault might become, I feel like this is my fault because it came from my genes, but I love my child and I would do anything for them. This is not about, thinking happy thoughts or trying to somehow just put a positive spin on it. This is about trying to nuance that thought or that idea a bit, and in doing so, hopefully the detail slightly dilutes or mitigates some of the potency of the guilt or the self-blame or the negative emotions associated with it. Now, that's hard to do, and it's hard to do, I think, unsupported. It is worth remembering, of course, that if you dial back to this idea of the stages of grief or stages of adjustment, while I said it was a bit archaic or slightly unfashionable, I find myself coming back to it repeatedly, which must mean there's something to it, right? And that model would suggest that guilt may be part of this process. There's a normal process of adjustment, and actually that guilt is a process through which a parent may just have to go through, and getting support from other people, I think, as part of that will be a hugely important task in trying to start to just soften that slightly. That type of emotion, it tends to thrive when it is kept in the dark and suppressed. It tends to be managed better when it's brought into the light, by which I mean discussed with other people. So talking to your partner about it, and I think also really importantly, talking to the parents who've perhaps been in a similar situation. So really difficult, really intense stuff, that guilt and blame, but hopefully can be managed with talking to partners, talking to other parents, and getting the right sort of information from the professionals too.
And some really kind of practical tips there, Ian. So we've looked at parents' reactions and how they cope in this situation. Have you got any other thoughts about reactions of other family members? So it might be siblings or whoever kind of lives with the child.
Yeah, absolutely. I think pretty much most of the things we're saying about parents could also be said to some extent about siblings and other members of the family, particularly those in the house. Any significant news particularly that that involves the health and well-being of a member of the family, will have an impact, obviously, on the other members of that family. And as we've said, there is an unpredictability to the way that could play out. You know, it may be that there are certain members of the family feeling particularly vulnerable anyway, and it might not be unreasonable to suspect it may have a particularly significant impact on them. But again, you know, this idea of the stages, this idea of different trajectories of adjustment, all bets are off. We don't know how different people will cope under these circumstances. Siblings, you know, their needs are often acknowledged, I think, in the research literature in this sort of area. The fact that siblings will have an emotional response to this, of course, and that emotional response may need to be, or in fact probably will need to be, addressed or supported in some way. Again, that's a very similar process, albeit a different level of understanding that the parents might go through. So again, the child in question, the sibling in question, how old are they? You know, based on their age, what information might they need? Again, this is a process of one parent, both parents, whoever is better placed, to find time to sit down with this child as uninterrupted as it's possible to be, and just check in with them how they are. And understanding better how they are, what they understand is going on with their sibling, what they might need. So it's very possible that if the parents are having problems understanding some complicated information, what chance may a four-year-old or a five-year-old have who's now worrying about their older sibling because they have an understanding that is maybe simplistic, and maybe they've not grasped entirely what the prognosis is. They may have a very distorted and very negative idea of what the future may hold for their siblings. So spending time with them, talking to them about what information they need, speaking to them about their fears, their level of understanding, they will take their cue, as will the child being diagnosed, of course, to some extent, in fact, to a greater extent, from their parents. And if you can have these sort of conversations as calmly as possible, and as uninterrupted as possible, and allowing for as much time as is possible, there's the best opportunity to model the fact that this is not something that the sibling needs to be as worried about as perhaps they may be, while acknowledging the fact that if this is their sibling, of course they're going to experience significant emotions, and of course they're going to be worried because this is an important person to them. There are child-specific resources. Again, I would, in the first instance, always point people towards the RNIB website. There are also sibling-specific resources and information that is worth thinking about. So there's a good website called SIBS, so S-I-B-S. I think the address is sibs.org.uk, which is Resources for Siblings of Disabled Children and Adults. So it's a very trans-diagnostic group. You know, the siblings of children and adults, of children and adults with all sorts of different diagnoses, but nonetheless, good resources there around how it may be to be a child in those circumstances and what support they may need to cope. So an awareness, I think, or particularly for the adults in the family, to stop and think, and focusing on the diagnosis of this child, and of course worrying primarily and firstly about the impact on them, have we started to neglect or not notice the impact on ourselves? And have we started to perhaps neglect the emotional impact on other people in the family, particularly siblings? And can we make time to try and think how everybody is, check in on everybody's emotional well-being, and try and equip them as best as we can with the information they need and with the support that they might want to? So yeah, really important question, and really important to think about everyone in the family too.
Yeah, and that does come up an awful lot, especially if a child is going through, you know, treatments and stuff for parents. Again, back to the guilt of feeling maybe guilty that they haven't been, maybe giving the rest of the siblings as much attention. And that is definitely a really tough one for families. I think also it's probably worth mentioning grandparents as well. A lot of our families, you know, grandparents are involved, but also that while, you know, the parent is getting this diagnosis, this is also, there's also another parent in a way, the parent of the parents, if you know what I mean. And it's something that they're experiencing as well, and often they can find quite challenging too.
Yeah, definitely. And it is about thinking, you know, when we see families, we well, I always, but I think most of my department probably are the same. We draw out family trees, you know, we draw out genograms, as we would call them. And there are many reasons, many very good reasons for doing that, but one of which is just to acknowledge the fact that a family is a system. You know, a family is a system and a family is a team. And there are all sorts of different ways people may be suffering or distressed that may be evident or masked. And if you want to optimize the well-being of any one person in the family, you sort of have to think about the needs of everyone in that family. And that might mean grandparents, it could mean aunts and uncles that live in the same house, or people have a lot of contact with. There may be parents experiencing huge amounts of guilt or blame that they're just not managing to articulate or seek help with. And fundamentally and primarily, it is the role of the parents, I think, to try and pause and reflect on that, you know, whose needs may not be being met right now with regard to this new and potentially life-changing bit of news. But again, you know, spending time with any professional involved in the care of the child who has the time to sit down with you and unpack some of this stuff, and that might be, again, the eye clinic liaison officer. That might mean the psychologist, like me, if there's one in the hospital that your child's being seen in, or one of a number of different professionals to sort of to reflect with them through a process of discussion of who do we need to think about, and almost go through the immediate members of the family in sequence and tick them off and think, okay, we know how they are. They're under control. We know how they are. They've got friends. Maybe they've got somebody to whom they can speak, and we know they're all right. Ah, who have we forgotten? Whose needs may not be entirely evident, or whose needs may be unmet, and how can we move towards looking after them too? So yeah, you're absolutely right. Again, this is another thing that varies family to family. Who we might need to think about in one family may be radically different and much less evident than who we might think about in another family.
Yeah. So I think really from kind of what we've gone over, I think it's really highlighted that obviously the most important thing is to talk, I think, definitely. Is there any other key points that you think we should remember, keep in mind?
Talking, I think, is the big one. I mean, the headline news, I think, and the thing that I'll keep coming back to is all bets are off. You know, there are so many reactions that I have seen, that people who've worked in this field will have seen, that are people just making sense of stuff. They're not pathological. It's just there are lots of different reactions, and understand that your own reaction may vary from what you expected. The reaction of your partner may vary from what you've expected, but that's just the process that some people may have to go through. So understand that in the first instance. Where possible, I think, as you said, Laura, talk. You know, find time to sit down with your partner, and in particular, I think, in the first instance, to think about how you both are. And if you are on the same page, great. If you're not, try and better understand how you're each dealing with this, how you may be suffering, how you may, in fact, be okay, what you may need your partner to do, and what they may be asking you to do for them, and try and negotiate things that feel possible. And some things, like we said before, around talking about the future in great depth may not feel possible at the moment. And if not, well, who can they speak to? So understand your own needs, understand your partner's needs, try and respond to them. If not, think about the RNIB Facebook pages, for example, other forums that they may be able to access support or information from. And information, professionals that are involved in your children's and your child's diagnosis or care, can they give you up-to-date information that may help to address any lack of understanding you may have? I think with the guilt stuff, self-blame, like I said, these can be really difficult emotions to try and deal with, particularly if they're not opened up. So try and connect with other people around that feeling. Be a partner, ideally, I think. If it's not a partner, someone else who's been in a similar position, I think, who can really empathise and validate what you're going through and help you to make sense of it. So perhaps one of the parents on the forum that we mentioned. If you feel able to, maybe you've been skilled up in this stuff before, you can try techniques like thought challenging, like we've mentioned. And again, I'd be very happy to try and stick a link in the description of this podcast to how to do that sort of technique. But again, you know, you have to be aware of everyone's needs in this system, and that has to include the parents. despite what you put in place, despite what information you have obtained or a conversation you've had with yourself, your partner, the parent of the child, the siblings of the child we're talking about, whoever else is in the family, if there are people who remain inadequately supported, if there's people who are really, really suffering from an emotional perspective and whose emotional state may be spiraling downwards, seek help for them. You know, there are many parents under these circumstances who do feel they need additional help, and that might be something like talking to one of the genetics counsellors and getting more information. It might be, in the end, going and talking to your GP and saying, look, the burden of this at the moment is too great to bear. Can I be referred to someone for some additional support or counselling? But the most important thing to acknowledge is everyone has needs in this system. Everybody's adjustment and coping will be different. And it is important to make sure everyone is looked after. And that means that nobody's needs are ignored or minimised to prioritise someone else, including the parents. And I think fairly often parents may feel, again, coming back to that idea, guilty when thinking about their own needs. But the needs of a parent or needs of a child are indivisible. And I think it's important that everybody is looked after here. And if that means supporting one another, great. But that means ultimately going outside the family, think about professional support from a psychologist at the Children's Hospital or from a counsellor that perhaps the GP could refer you to. It remains desperately important. So yeah, I think those are definitely the take-home messages.
Yeah,
I guess if we're saying if parents are struggling at the moment, they're kind of listening to this, and it's really brought up some emotions. Definitely, do feel free. Our helpline number is at the end of this podcast, and please do feel free to give us a call, and somebody at RNIB will be able to offer some support. So thanks again, Ian and Laura, for joining us today. Yeah, and thank you very much for those listening in. Hopefully it's been useful. Yeah, feel free to click on other podcasts in this series. And yeah, and join us again. Take care, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
If you found this helpful, you can listen to further podcasts in this series. You can find additional information at rnib.org.uk/children or email our team directly on cypf@rnib.org.uk. You can also call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999. And for further information on Fight Against Blindness, visit fightagainstblindness.org. Standing with you through every challenge, RNIB see differently.